Welcome to the September Citizens Climate Lobby call. My name is Mark Reynolds. I'm a member of the Citizens Climate Lobby staff, and I'll be hosting today's call. Last Friday, information was leaked from the Senate Finance Committee that they were considering a price on carbon. We could be seeing the first draft of the reconciliation package as soon as the 15th. It's unlikely that they'll hit that deadline, but they could. Either way, whether that draft was included in the initial reconciliation or it's not, we will be ready to go. We've been making plans. If the draft reconciliation plan includes a price, and if it doesn't include a price, we'll be ready to go. We'll be letting you know what our action plan is, and we'll be rolling information out quickly. Our quote leak experts suggest that usually people leak something when they want to do it, when they're in favor of it. We don't know who leaked it. We didn't leak it. We don't know who did, but it's our belief that people who did leaked it because they wanted to send out something like a trial balloon and see if there were problems or if it would be gain traction. So anyhow, we should see something possibly this week, maybe next week, but we'll be ready to respond. Here's the thing that I think is important for all of you to see. What was leaked was a $15 rising carbon price, money rebated to households with a border carbon adjustment. So it's not just the press you've been making over the last few months. It's very interesting that the argument you've been making for years, your price, your barter adjustment, money going back to households is the argument you've been making. So I think no matter what the initial reconciliation package looks like, you should congratulate yourself on a job well done, because now we're seeing actual language in the worksheet for the Senate Finance Committee. Okay, what's going to happen today? In just a moment, I'll be introducing our guest, Aaron Cosby. We have been wanting a speaker on the border carbon adjustment for quite some time, and we're really excited that at this moment we have Aaron Cosby joining us. After that, we're going to go over what we're asking you to do this month, which we have a new action that we've added that's not on your action sheet, but we'll put a link in the chat. We'd like you to now also email President Biden. After that, we're going to go over what's been happening since last month's call, kind of the overall push and some of the highlights that have happened. So our guest, Aaron Cosby, International Institute for Sustainable Development, is an economist with 30 years of experience in the areas of trade, investment, and sustainable development. He has served on the Deputy Minister, for International Trade's Academic Advisory Council on the Canadian Trade Policy, and recently wrote a paper on the need for Canada to adopt a carbon border adjustment. You should see the number of task force advisory boards, review boards that Aaron's a member of that include things like sustainability, trade, climate change. This is just someone who a lot of people are seeking his advice. Aaron, there's a couple of things I'd like you to know about the people that you're talking to before I turn things over to you. One is, you know, lots of times the way people listen to a speaker is from kind of the model of right and wrong. How can I go prove to other people that I'm right and they're wrong? The people who are listening today know that the stakes are higher than that. And what they're listening for is, how is this going to help us solve the problem? They're desperate for any piece of information that will help them do that. Here's the other thing you should know about them. If these CCLers were talking to their friends and family about, you know, what are you doing over the weekend? And their friends and family said, you know, I'm going on a hike, I'm, you know, going to the grocery store. They would say, I'm going to talk on a border carbon adjustment and I'm fired up about that. So those are the people that you're talking to. Aaron Cosby, welcome. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks, Mark. It's really good to be here. And I'm excited to be talking about border carbon adjustment on a weekend too. So I don't know what that says about me. I should start out by saying that I'm grateful to be coming to you from the traditional lands of the Senext and Xenaha nations here in Canada, in interior British Columbia, where we've been under a horribly intense season of wildfires and heat domes. So for me, this has always had a personal stake for me, but I think for many more British Columbians and people in the west of the United States, it has a particularly poignant stake at this point. I'm going to talk to you a little bit about first what border carbon adjustment is, then what the recent trends are and the developments within the EU and Canada, and finish up with what the implications are for US policy. I'm going to try to do all that in about 10 or 12 minutes, so to leave some time for questions and answers after that. So forgive me if I can't dive down into the depths of it in my presentation, but we can get to it in question and answer. So for starters, what is border carbon adjustment? It deals with, it's an instrument that deals with a basic problem. And that is, if you adopt ambitious climate policy domestically, what you're doing is raising the cost of production, particularly for what we call energy intensive trade exposed sectors. There's a clutch of these well-known sectors. We're talking about steel, talking about cement, talking about fertilizers, nitrogen fertilizers, talking about aluminum. And these are also, because they're highly traded, the domestic producers can't just raise the price on those and pass those prices along to consumers. They will be undercut by foreign producers that aren't facing those same climate policies, because we are in a world of uneven climate ambition. So how do you deal with that? Border carbon adjustment is one way you might deal with it. And we're not talking about, I should stress, a single instrument about which I can tell you its legal status, its effectiveness, because there are so many. Border carbon adjustment is more like a decision tree. There are all of these design option features, like points of division within a decision tree, where if you pick one, you go in a particular direction, the final result looks extremely different depending on the design elements that you choose in elaborating it. But all of them are designed to address the central problem of what we call leakage. The idea that when you put strong climate policy in place, all that you do is increase the emissions somewhere outside of your jurisdiction, either because they're taking market share or your firms are relocating to that location and then trading back the goods to you. It's not what we're trying to achieve through strong climate policy. The idea that any climate any BCA will look very different is exemplified in the difference between the FAIR Act introduced by Peters and Kuhn in the States and the European Union CBAM that I'm going to talk about in a little bit. You can't help but have a climate BCA that looks different in different jurisdictions, because the BCA is not really a standalone instrument. It's an accompaniment to climate policy. And every country's climate policy is going to look extremely different. Canada's looks the way it does because we have a pricing system that's quite different from the European Union system, which would be different from the proposed CCL system in the States. And therefore, the accompanying border carbon adjustment, which is trying to equalize conditions at the border based on the domestic climate regime, is going to look different in any country that puts it in place. A final word on what BCA is. This is an instrument that is a rabbit hole of complexity, a set of rabbit holes. It's complex. It sounds intuitively easy, but it's extremely complex to put it into practice. It's imperfect in terms of its effectiveness. It's controversial. It creates huge trade frictions between partners. It creates friction within the multilateral climate change negotiations, creates diplomatic friction. Potentially, it's illegal under WTO rules, but it happens to be probably the least worst solution we've got to deal with the problem of trying to increase climate ambition in a world of uneven climate ambition. So with that as a quick introduction, let me tell you a little bit about what the European Union is doing. We have a proposal on the table from the European Council or European Commission for a CBAM, a carbon border adjustment mechanism, a BCA by another name. It would cover five sectors: steel, aluminum, fertilizers, electricity. It would cover 30 different subsectors within those basic sectors. Cement, sorry, is the one I left off. And it has a couple of important features relevant to US policy. One, it will credit foreign prices paid for carbon in the country of export. So the adjustment at the border will be reduced by whatever carbon price was paid in the country of export, but it will not credit foreign regulatory policies, non-price policies. And of course, the US does not yet have a carbon price in place, so no credit for US exporters. It will not also create any national exemptions based on ambitious climate policy. So Brazil could have the most ambitious deforestation policy on earth, and it would be highly climate effective, but will receive no credit under the European CBAM as proposed. The process is that this is designed to come in place by 2023. There'll be a transition phase until 2026 in which charges aren't applied. It's just a record keeping phase. And then over the period 2026 to 2035, it's gradually phased in as free allowance under the EU emissions trading system is phased out. the proposal from the EC being on the table is now a matter of negotiation between the Council, which is a representative of the member states, and the European Parliament to come to a final piece of legislation, which, as I say, is designed to be put in place by 2023. Quickly on where Canada is, Canada has a very ambitious climate policy, among other things, that involves a carbon pricing regime that has us currently at Canadian $50 a ton, that's about 35 US, rising up to $170 a ton, about 130 US by 2030. It's one of the most ambitious climate pricing schemes in the world. That's enshrined in law. And there's an Accountability Act also enshrined in law to make sure we get there. Given that, and what I said earlier about the need to accompany that kind of ambition with some kind of protective mechanism, we have also been talking about a border carbon adjustment. We've been talking about it ever since we put the carbon price in place. And we have, just before the election was announced earlier last month, we launched a consultation on border carbon adjustment in Canada. The government launched a formal consultation on what it might look like. So they've been consulting with private sector, they've been consulting with experts and research institutes, interested stakeholders about what the border carbon adjustment might look like. We are, as you might know, in the middle of a federal election designed to be concluded within the next 2 weeks. And all the major parties in the election have called for some kind of border carbon adjustment, even if, to be honest, most of them don't really know what that means. But we can be sure that it's coming in place in Canada. Let me wrap this up with what that means for the United States. We are in a world of countries starting to take climate change action seriously. It's not just the EU, it's not just Canada. All of the major emitting countries in the G7 are starting to get serious about their ambition on climate change, and other countries as well, China, India, South Africa. So in the context of that kind of ambition, we are going to see countries adopting instruments like border carbon adjustment. It's going to happen. The EU is going to put one in place. Canada is going to put one in place. If the United States, at the time those come into place, does not have a carbon price, its manufacturers, its exporters of those covered goods are going to be put at a disadvantage. And it doesn't matter what kind of climate ambition the US has in terms of a regulatory approach. If there's no carbon price in place, I can guarantee you there will be no exemptions put in place for US goods. They will face penalties based on their carbon intensity. That's the basic fact. And as Mark said, you want to know what all this means for US policy? It means the US should probably have a carbon price in place, or it will suffer the consequences of becoming less competitive on the international stage in all of those covered sectors. I'm going to stop there because I know there's probably a lot of questions. We can deep dive into the details of the EU scheme, into the details of what those kinds of schemes mean as they relate to US policy. But let me stop there and get more conversation going as opposed to a lecture.
Okay, well, let me just say, first of all, that was fantastic and very, very helpful. Flannery, what are you seeing so far? And can you remind people, if they want to ask a question, what's the best format to actually get considered?
Sure, yes. If you have questions, you can put them in the Q&A feature of Zoom. And we have a question here from Leland, who's asking sort of a practical, tactical question, which is, when Canada exports oil to the US, what, if any, carbon fee is charged? So with that example, can you just kind of talk us through the idea?
So the border carbon adjustment, I should have said, is typically thought of as an import instrument. So there's a charge on stuff that gets imported to your country if you put one of these in place. You can also think of a border carbon adjustment that relieves those charges on exports. And it's the same way a value-added tax works. Canada has a value, most countries in the world, the US doesn't, but most countries in the world have a value-added tax. They charge their domestic producers. Goods that come in are charged as if they were produced domestically, and then exported goods are relieved of that tax with a rebate at the border. So border carbon adjustment might work in the same way. For complicated legal reasons, it won't work that way in the EU or Canada. You won't have an export rebate. But the oil that's exported from Canada to the US, therefore, has faced a carbon price within Canada, or will have faced a carbon price rising up to, as I said, $170 a ton by 2030. That carbon price will have been paid by oil producers in Canada. Oil is one of the covered sectors. It's not a full price. I think we can get into the details. There is output-based allocation in the same way they have free allocation in the EU. So that the effective carbon price is less than that, but that will have been paid. If the US had a border carbon adjustment in place, I'm not sure if that's what you're asking, then the US would charge Canada for the carbon embedded in its oil imports. And as we know, most of the oil imports from the States or to the States from Canada are from Canada's oil sands, and that's the most carbon intensive form of oil production. So there would be a hefty fee charged on that oil coming into the States based on its carbon intensity, with some credit, I assume, for the carbon price that was paid in Canada before it got exported. I don't know if I've answered that question or not.
Yeah, no, that's great. So we have another question here from Rody. Sorry if I'm mispronouncing that. But he's asking, the five EU sectors don't include coal, natural gas, or oil. And he's asking, why is that?
The reason you choose your sectors based on the risk of leakage. The refinery sector is not particularly at risk of leakage in the EU. The EU emissions trading system is based on activities. So the mining of coal, the refining of gasoline, not the products themselves. So the risk is whether if you put a charge under the ETS on refining of fuels, will you get a lot of imported fuels that haven't been subject to that same charge? And their estimation was that refined fuels didn't face a particularly high risk of leakage, although there is some risk of leakage. There is coal. The EU doesn't import a whole lot of coal. So there's not, the mining of coal is emissions intensive. But coal itself has a good, they don't import much of it. The risk of leakage is very low there. Natural gas, good question. There's not a lot of natural gas produced in Europe. And so they don't see really a need to put a border carbon adjustment in place on that. Most of their natural gas is imported. The ETS, the underlying instrument that border carbon, the CBAM is going to be accompanying, does tax fuels on the basis of their carbon content, taxes electricity on the basis of its carbon content. So any coal-fired electricity is going to be paying the ETS fee, which currently runs at €60 a ton of carbon and is going nowhere but up. So there's a hefty charge on those fuels as used in transport and electricity generation, but not a border carbon adjustment because there's no particular risk of leakage.
Flannery, I have a question, Flannery, that I also saw in the chat, so if I could ask this. Aaron, what about California, the REGI states? Is anything taken into account in the European BCA for those states that are pricing carbon?
Yeah, so that's an interesting feature of the proposed CBAM that you can, it's not just a national carbon price. So if you can show that, if a verifier in the States can show that a carbon price was paid on a product, doesn't have to be a national price, could be REGI, could be WCI, right? Then that's valid. You can get credit for that. Sorry, I should have mentioned that. So sub-regional schemes are good.
Okay, cool. Flannery, back to you, sorry.
No problem. Okay, we have a question from Krista asking, how does a price on carbon affect things like the Line 3 pipeline that's currently under construction? Canada has a price on carbon, yet the pipeline construction still seems to be coming out as profitable. So does that mean that the current carbon tax just isn't high enough yet? Or how does it interact with that?
Yeah, that's it. If we're looking at the economics of exporting oil from Canada, the current carbon price is only $50 a ton or $35 US a ton. And there is output-based allocation, so they're not facing that full price, right? And it's rising though quickly. By the time we get to 2030, $170 a ton or $130 US. At that point, the economics of that pipeline may not make any sense. You know, and that's combined with, you know, in my opinion, we're straying off the border carbon adjustment topic here. But in my opinion, global markets for oil are going to be by 2030 in decline anyway. Demand will be down, prices will be down. So you combine that with the high prices we've put on carbon in Canada and the potentially a carbon budget for the oil sector, which has been announced by most of the candidates in the current election, that ramps down production in the sector. Line three probably doesn't make sense economically.
Okay, this is, I imagine, a quick one. Peter is asking, would a carbon border adjustment apply to all manufactured goods?
No, so that's a good question. So you've got, so steel is covered under the, let's take the CBAM as an example. The CBAM covers steel, and it covers something like 15 or 16 subsectors of steel, hot rolled steel, flat steel, right? It does not cover automobiles that are manufactured by using steel, right? So the coverage of the CBAM only goes down from the very basic goods to the next level of slightly processed goods, but does not continue down to automobiles. The reason for that is as you go down the value chain, so an automobile's got a lot of steel in it, but as a percentage of value added, the carbon cost in an automobile is very low. So even if you did put a carbon price on steel in the EU, it's not going to make that much difference to the final price of an automobile that you would give rise to a risk of leakage, right? So as you go down the value chain to more processed, more manufactured goods, that risk of leakage drops. And the cost pass-through isn't perfect in every stage. So the short answer to your question is no, manufactured goods won't be covered. We're just talking about the basic goods and slightly processed goods.
And Flannery, if I could jump in for just a second again, I want to remind everybody of one of the earlier comments you made, which is there's not an is border carbon adjustment. They're all going to be designed differently based on the pricing mechanism of that entity or country. And let's say that we get what we've been arguing for, which is a steadily rising price in U.S. on carbon-based emissions. So that when that, would the European Union adjust that every year based on what our price and their price is?
That's right. Yeah. Okay. So there's two adjustments they would have to make. One would be for the carbon price paid in the US, and the other would be an adjustment on their end for any free allocation that they've granted their domestic industry. So you'd be credited on both sides there. I should put it as a footnote. One of the advantages of having a carbon tax is you can actually rebate the tax on export. One of the big challenges the CBAM faces in getting implemented is that export-oriented industries in the EU don't see any protection for their exports, right? For legal reasons, you can't, on a regulatory regime like an emissions trading scheme, you can't rebate the costs. On a tax, you can. So if the US puts a tax in place, it's ahead of the game, it's ahead of the EU scheme, it's ahead of the Canadian scheme. We can't rebate costs at the border either because we don't have a tax.
Back to you, Flannery.
All right. Michael is asking, can you elaborate on why the U.S. would be at a disadvantage if we do not have a border carbon adjustment?
Yeah. So let's say you've got a U.S. Producer of steel, and they're not subject to a carbon tax, and they're exporting to the EU. The EU, and let's say you've also got a Canadian producer of steel, same cost structure, same everything. The Canadian producer of steel gets rebated. There's an adjustment for both of them when they show up at the EU border, right? The Canadian one gets the adjustment reduced by the amount of carbon tax that was paid in Canada. Not strictly a carbon tax, but I'm going to call it a carbon tax. The American one does not. So the American one faces the full adjustment. The Canadian one faces less of an adjustment because they have been subject to a carbon tax at home. That's the more countries that have steel producers facing a carbon tax, the more disadvantage that American producer has because it's paying the full CBAM costs while other producers are paying less.
Yeah, I think that's been one of our arguments about a border carbon adjustment is that we believe that American manufacturing in general is less carbon intensive than many other countries. And this is actually a way to improve our competitiveness. Do you share that opinion?
That's a tough question. I've seen those models. Look, I've actually gone and tried to figure out the carbon intensity of various countries and various sectors, and it's not as easy as it might sound. And the modeling that underlies the argument you just made, I don't think is completely, anyway, that's an open question. Let me put it that way. It's a good lobbying point, but it's an open question.
Thank you. Plenary?
Scott is asking, what prevents the U.S. from just waiting until 2026, since there's no carbon border adjustment enforced until then? You're talking about the phase-in period. What prevents us?
Nothing except that it takes a long time to put in place a proper scheme. So you know the legislative process in the states as well as I do. The idea that if you decided today to put in place a carbon price, when do you think it would actually take effect? You've got to go through the legislative process to get it going. Even when you've got final legislation, certainly it wouldn't start the day the legislation is enacted. You would have to have a phase-in period where you get your data and your systems up to speed. So the only thing that keeps you from doing that is the fact that if it takes a long time to put a good pricing scheme in place.
Okay, we've got time for one more, Flannery. Do you have another one there?
One more? Yeah. Would just like to ask to wrap up, what sort of impact do you think that it would make internationally if the U.S. had both a border carbon adjustment and a domestic carbon price in place?
Make a lot of people happy. No, it would, I don't think you can discount the leadership effect of something like that. The U.S.'s leadership on climate internationally, as you know, has suffered, not most recently, but certainly during the Trump administration. Currently, the EU is the flag bearer, assisted by countries like Canada sometimes. But to have an alliance of the EU, the US, I think you would start to force the hand of countries like China and India, who are ambitious, but not to the extent they might be if they understood that the US, the EU were putting in place these kinds of measures. The global economy is changing. We're taking account of carbon in traded goods. China is a major trader. The pressure on other countries to act becomes much more acute if the US is part of that club of actors.
Great, thank you. That's our belief also, and thank you for affirming that. Aaron, thank you so much. This was fantastic. I bet this will be one of the most replayed videos we have. It is an area where our volunteers and our staff and our boards are really, really interested in. They want to make sure that they have the best, the most up-to-date information. And I think we all feel like we're in much better shape after this.
Great. Well, thank you. Thank you for your interest. It's a really important topic right now.
Yeah, great. Thank you. And again, you're welcome to stay on for the next 10 or 12 minutes if you want, but I do understand it's one of the last summers in Canada and where you live.
It's getting cold.
Yeah. Okay, cool. I'm going to go over what we're going to be doing this month, and then I'll be talking about kind of laying out what the effort has been over the last several months and how things are going forward. So first of all, what are we doing? Well, it's not on your action sheet, so you won't see it there, but we have added an action of contacting the White House. Our consultants say that emailing the White House is way more effective than calling them. So in the chat today, you can see a link for how to do that. That link also provides you a chance to reach out to your senators again. And I'll go over the numbers of people in a little bit who've already taken action on that, but we would like you to contact the White House at this point. The other thing we're doing is we're asking you to reach out to community leaders to personally call their members of Congress. Those are mayors, anybody who's influenced in your community, anybody who you see as influence, who already hasn't signed up as an endorser of either energy innovation or just the dividend in general. We want as many voices as possible saying that it's important to price carbon at this moment. Also, we'd like you to write as many letters to the editor as possible. There's been a lot of great work recently, 4 pieces in the New York Times on one day, where I am in San Diego. The San Diego editorial page has basically been taken over by CCL. And we've gotten a ton of op-eds recently, and this whole year, which I'll go over in a little bit. But we really want to have a huge letter effort. There's certainly all kinds of material out there that should give us an easy way into the newspaper. Again, we know that the best way to get published is to respond to something in the paper. They want to say that they're setting the news. We're responding to that. Also, one of the things that's been really interesting and a nice side benefit of our campaign is over half the people who reached out to members of the House and Senate weren't CCLers. So there's a huge opportunity to onboard people. We have new onboarding tools. So if you could use this as an opportunity to do so, that would be great. Bonus social action is for you to tweet about carbon pricing, and the communication exercise is about the border carbon adjustment. So I hope you all get a chance to practice that. Okay, I want to talk about our strategic initiatives now and kind of what has happened, what is going to happen, and what is coming on the overall broad effort. So there's three things that are in place right now. One is the reconciliation mobilization that I would imagine everybody who's on this call or listening to the recording is part of that process that's with the House and Senate, and we'll be translating over to the president also now. Then there's an influence awareness campaign that started in April and will continue on. And then the third is a key state initiative. So we identified six states that are important politically, but also where we thought we had a chance to make a difference with that senator. And so we've just begun part of that with the calling and tweeting campaign. Will you be hearing more about that soon? Okay, so the whole thing is part of a push for carbon prices in the reconciliation process. And you know, your extraordinary effort over the last couple of months is just really been something to watch and be part of. So what did we do? We asked CCL supporters to take action. CCL supporters encouraged and asked friends and family. And again, more than half the people who participated are people that weren't previously part of CCL. This is the first time all my kids and my wife did something that was exciting for me. So we put ads on Facebook. So then we've added a couple of things. One is we're doing phone banking to existing CCL supporters. And so far as part of this campaign, we have called 114,894 people have been called so far. So for all of you who are part of that phone banking, thank you so much. Text banking is a little bit different. First of all, if you decide you want to sign up for text banking, you don't do it from your phone. You actually do it from your computer. And these are purchase lists. So these are not CCL volunteers. These are people outside the organization that we're reaching out to ask to be part of the process. So far, 148,905 people have received texts as part of this text program. In terms of the Biden action so far, 5,221 people have emailed the Biden White House. There's a follow-on action as soon as you email the president, where it gives you a chance to email your senators again. 7,268 people have done that so far. So if you've not done texting, you're interested in it, Brett will add in the chat how you could actually be part of that outreach effort. Okay, so what did we do in the Senate? First thing we did in the Senate is we set a goal of having 10,000 people reach out to their senators. What ended up happening is we had a specific timeline. More people have done it, but we had a two-week period. We said, let's see what we can do in 2 weeks. In 2 weeks, 21,389 people took action. 51,077 contacts were made, and 7,733 phone calls. And we exceeded our goals in every key state. So every state that we thought we needed extra focus on, we exceeded our goals. So we considered states of particular interest are states like Arizona, West Virginia, and Utah. What about the House? We set a goal of getting 10,000. We believed that it would be a little bit more difficult to reach the House goal than the Senate goal. It was in fact a little bit trickier, but we were able to exceed the goal also. You know, it isn't like states where you can have the whole state maybe make up for some places where we're stronger and places that we're not as strong. So we were happy that we hit the goal, but we also had another really nice side benefit. We were able to identify specific district where we want to target our outreach so that we can have more members, so that in every district, there's a lot more people who would have a chance to reach out, and identifying those was a big deal. What about the grass tops mobilization? We emailed the thousands of people and organizations who had endorsed Fee and Dividend or the Energy Innovation Act and asked them to take action. Then the delegate to that particular endorser reached out to them also, and we asked them to contact Congress to support a carbon price. You know, some people got a little anxious during this campaign that, you know, we've always been a fee and dividend shop. We are a fee and dividend shop, and that is our proposal. But we're working also with a firm, which I'll talk to in a little bit, and we're after a broader persuasion campaign. So there's particular ways I like to describe fee and dividend or pricing carbon. They wanted us to use the term pricing carbon because search engines find that. And so it's not just that we wanted to be doing outreach. It's that when people were searching for price, for what we're after, that would actually grab them. So it was a broader effort. It made some people a little nervous. We're not walking away from fee and dividend. We were on a broader persuasion campaign. And we know how important Grass Tops is because probably everybody who's listening to this live or the recording has been in lobby meetings. And you know, one of the questions often asked is, what are the job creators? What are the businesses in my district say about this? Okay, so what about the influencer awareness campaign, building support for carbon price? So we have been for years working on five levers of political will. And in this case, we said, we need to do something outside the box. We need to do something, you know, we need to leave no stone unturned. So we contracted with a firm called Bully Pulpit Interactive. If you go on their website, you'll see that the typical client is a pretty prestigious client, up to big things, trying to generally do good things. And we hired them to do a few things for us, to support us in press and earned media, to help us with paid advertising, to target list of influencers, and maybe most important, because of the database they had of influencers. So they have a huge database of over 300,000 people who are people that are really of interest to us in actually reaching them. So they included work with us on strategic and tactical support, direct outreach to reporters. We've got a pretty good database of reporters and we have do a good job of staying in on that, but we were really able to expand our effort. We got more calls from reporters because of it. And the nice thing is, because we had people in addition to us who worked on this area, who had a lot of expertise, we're able to build capacities internally where there's now things we can do that we didn't have the capacity to before, but now we do. And it was not just what we'd done, but also what BPI was able to add to the party. Two of the op-eds written by BPI were particularly helpful. One that was published in a West Virginia paper and the other in Indian Country Today. One of the reasons the one from Indian Country Today was so important to us is because the American Indian voices are so important to Senator Sinema. So that was particularly helpful. On the paid media, we reached policymakers, their staff, and those who influence them, as well as employees of key federal agencies, White House and Hill staff, party committees, lobbyists, industry groups, and key climate organizations. We had ads on Facebook, Precision Network, Google Search, The Hill, Politico, Washington Examiner, New York Times, and The Wall Street Journal. The awareness campaign made sure that carbon pricing is in the front of influencers. And again, carbon pricing was something people do search for. So that's why it was so important to us to do it that way. What are some of the things we got? Videos, display ads, native content. An example of native content is a lot of you saw the op-ed published in Utah by a bunch of existing and former Republican lawmakers calling for a carbon price in the Deseret News, the paper that is essentially owned by the Mormon Church. And they were able to push that out to other areas. We reached at least 567,486 people on an average of 19 times. And in terms of videos that we sent out, 1,655,291 completed video views and broad reach in places like Politico, The Hill, The New York Times, et cetera. Okay, then the last thing is we've begun a process of key state initiatives. We've identified six states. We've just begun the work in terms of texting and phone banking. You'll see more of this coming. But there are key states where we believe we have the people that we can reach, people that we can influence, and we have strong chapters. So you'll see more of that coming. Okay, well, a couple of other things that have happened just since last month's call. So last month, we published 91 op-eds. That puts us at 586 op-eds year to date. That is the second most op-eds in the history of this organization in a year. So that's still with a quarter to go. You know, I want to thank our great communications staff of getting so many templates out to everybody, but for you particularly in getting those out there and published. So I mentioned also, those of you who got the New York Times pieces that day, fantastic. My paper, the San Diego Union, which I get a print copy every morning, they've had at least 10 pieces in the last 3 weeks. So let's keep that push up. Okay, last two things. One is one of those Utah state legislatures who signed the open op-ed in the Deseret News will be our speaker for next month. And as soon as information drops on the reconciliation package, we will be informing you of the steps we're taking and any information that we have available to get you out there. Again, Aaron Cosby, thank you so much for joining us. Thank you all for all you're doing. We'll see you next month. Bye, everybody.
What is a carbon fee and dividend? And how does it help solve climate change? Burning fossil fuels causes carbon pollution, which traps heat and warms our planet to dangerous levels. To stabilize our climate, we need to stop carbon pollution. How? By changing the rules to the game. Right now, carbon pollution is free for everyone. With a carbon fee and dividend, fossil fuel companies pay a fee when they pollute the air. Since most companies like saving money, they'll change their behavior to avoid the carbon fee. They will become more energy efficient or clean up their act with cleaner energy. With this policy, our carbon pollution goes down while green goods and services go mainstream. Costs for some things will go up, but for many purchases, we'll be able to substitute a greener choice. And as businesses move to greener products, they'll provide us with more affordable green options. For example, car companies will shift to producing affordable electric cars. And power companies will replace fossil fuels with clean energy. And remember that carbon fee? The money collected from fossil fuel companies goes to every American as a monthly dividend or carbon cashback. People can spend the monthly cashback however they want to, helping everyone afford the transition to green energy. When we stop burning fossil fuels, our air will be clean, our health will improve, and our climate will stabilize. All we need is a price on carbon with the money given back to the people. Learn how you can support putting a price on carbon at cclusa.org.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Citizens Climate Lobby's training program. You can tune into more episodes anywhere podcasts are available. Inspired by what you heard today? Join Citizens Climate Lobby to advocate for bipartisan climate solutions. Go to community.citizensclimate.org to find more trainings, resources, your local chapter, national action teams, discussion forums, and more. Be sure to like our Facebook page and follow us on Twitter and Instagram at Citizens Climate. We also invite all of our listeners to subscribe to our YouTube channel for more inspiration. And together, we are creating the political will for a livable world.